We are now joined on the phone by Professor Marlene Zook. Dr. Zook is a professor of ecology, evolution, and behavior at the University of Minnesota, and is the author of a recently published book entitled Paleo Fantasy: What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. Dr. Zook, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And let's start perhaps by you giving us a simple definition of paleo fantasy.
Sure. I can't take credit for coining the word. It came from an article I read in Science magazine by Leslie Aiello, who's an anthropologist and the head of the Wennergren Foundation, which is a big anthropology foundation. And she was at a conference where people were discussing various scenarios that anthropologists had constructed about human brain evolution. And, of course, it's difficult to know what people were thinking hundreds of thousands of years ago. And so she said, and this ended up being the title of the coverage of the conference, human brain evolution, do we have the facts, or are we just making up, or are we just talking about paleo fantasies? And so what she really meant was stories that we construct about the way life was like a long time ago. And I think we use those stories to think about modern life as well.
And I saw a quote where you said that these fantasies sort of derive from the idea that evolution makes tiny, tiny changes over millions of years. So in the modern industrial world, we just haven't had time to adjust, and that we'd be better off going back to the ancient times. And that's
yeah.
A fantasy.
Yeah, there's a couple of different fantasies in there, actually. But I think primarily most people are taught, and in a way there's nothing wrong with this, that evolution takes a long time because you're looking at really small changes in the genes that are happening over thousands and millions of years. And so if changes in the environment happen quickly, the way they certainly have for humans in just really a few thousand years, then the genetic changes just couldn't keep pace, and so we're really suited to an environment a long time ago, perhaps, although it's never quite clear, it depends on who you want to talk to about this, but perhaps a period when humans were living as hunter-gatherers in small groups and certainly didn't have all kinds of modern conveniences like, technology or, telephones or television or computers, and also were living without agriculture, and so they were getting most of their food by hunting and gathering. So, the idea is, all right, well, that's how we evolved, and so modern life has just not kept pace with this, and so we're terribly mismatched with our environment. And, there's a level at which that's true, because certainly, a lot of physicians, for example, will point out that part of our problems with diabetes and obesity are that, our bodies are simply not constructed such that they can easily handle a lot of really calorie-dense but nutritionally poor food that's around all the time. And when we do ingest all that food that, is kind of empty calories or junk, then we develop insulin resistance or, get fat or something like that.
And you go in your book into detail onto a number of routes that people go down in their thinking that are really a little misleading and misunderstanding how evolution really works.
Well, because of course the business with the obesity and diabetes is absolutely true that, yes, our genes are not adjusted to the way modern food often is, or at least modern food in a Western industrial society is prepared and, served and so forth. But that's really different than saying that, we'd all be better off if we simply ate like people ate before
Sure.
there was agriculture, or that, and I think taking a step further, it's also really different than saying that, human evolution hasn't really changed much, and we've got what some people will refer to as, Stone Age genes in, the Space Age, although, I don't know, people tend not to use the phrase the Space Age anymore. That's kind of a, people use that, a few decades ago, but you get the idea.
Yeah, it's the nature of evolution that we're always behind. There's always changes coming at us. That's sort of the way you describe it in your book, I think. But what I thought maybe it would be helpful if we could just back off a second and just talk about the basic process of evolution. How does it work? What are the factors that contribute to change in an organism?
Sure, and I think that that helps give a better perspective, too, on this idea of, you know, has it stopped, is it still ongoing, right, and so forth. And, of course, the basic principles are really simple that, you know, as we all know, populations of organisms have a lot of variability. You know, individuals are different from each other. Those differences can be due to our genes, to factors that are passed on from parents to offspring. If some of those differences mean that you survive and reproduce better, then you're going to be able to pass on your genes to the succeeding generations. Those genes will become more prevalent in the population, and the population will have evolved through natural selection. Now, two other points. One of them is that evolution, which is simply described as changes in the genes in a population, can happen without natural selection. So you can get random factors that change the genes. You can get migration changing the genes. So if you have new individuals that come in with their genes into the new population, then that will change things. And it doesn't mean that selection's happened. It just means that you've had migration. There's a couple of other things that can do that. So selection, natural selection and evolution are not the same thing. So evolution happens through natural selection, but that's not the only way it can happen. And then the other point is that individuals can't evolve. So, you know, colloquially you'll say, oh, well, my thinking about that particular issue has evolved on this, or, you know, I've had personal, you know, a personal evolution in the way that I, you know, listen to music, or, you know, something like that. And that's fine for a colloquial usage, but that's not really accurate from a scientific perspective, because only populations can evolve, because the genes you were born with are the genes you kind of got forever. So,
yeah,
so that, you can't change those.
Yeah, you took away one of my questions.
That was, oh,
I mean,
all right.
it was a curious thought that, you know, I wonder if I evolve in any way, shape, or form. I mean, certainly
you do not.
Your thinking
you're stuck. You completely do not. It's a sad thing, but there you go.
That's what makes it.
So evolution is not the same thing as just change, because, of course, you change. We all change, but change is not the same thing as evolution.
Right. So a lot of what you talk about relates to what we know now about the speed of evolution and the old thinking of eons and eons and minuscule changes is a little different now. Could you describe a little bit the current thinking on speed?
Absolutely, yeah. One of the fun things about new techniques in biology now is that we can look in amazing detail at the genome, at our whole collection of genes, and ask questions about how they've changed in different populations. So you can say, well, how are genes different from people in people from different places? How are they different now than they've been in the past? And we can do this either by looking at ancient DNA, DNA from people, and their remains from a long time ago, and a variety of other techniques. And what that's telling us is that genetic change happens over generations that are much fewer than we ever would have thought. And that's true not just for people, but for other organisms as well. So there's a whole field of study, sometimes called rapid evolution, sometimes called evolution in an ecological time scale, mm-hmm. which means that evolution is happening fast enough that it influences the ecology in a given place. So evolution can happen in a very few generations. It's not something where, oh, it takes millions of years and we're just talking about, you know, when the dinosaurs arose. Instead, increasingly, we're realizing that evolution's happening all the time and changes are happening all the time, and sometimes those changes are pretty drastic.
Yeah, you mentioned, or maybe you didn't mention, but in the book you mentioned lactose intolerance, for example, as a way you can see the speed of evolution in a different scale.
I love talking about lactose tolerance, or lactase persistence, it's sometimes mm-hmm. called, because our ability to digest dairy products is, in my opinion, one of the most amazing examples of evolution in action that's happened really recently. So as everybody probably knows, people who are so-called lactose intolerant can't digest dairy products, and the reason they can't digest dairy products is that they lack an enzyme called lactase that breaks down lactose, which is a sugar that is present in milk. And all mammals, of course, drink milk, including people, when they're infants. That's what kind of makes us mammals. Mm-hmm. But mostly, mammals lose that ability to digest dairy products in milk once they're weaned. In a lot of populations of humans, however, that's not the case, and we have what's called lactase persistence, so that enzyme has persisted in a few populations. And we think that's happened through a process called gene culture coevolution. So imagine that, and it happened like really fast in just 5,000 to 7,000 years, which is incredibly fast from an evolutionary perspective. So imagine that, you know, 5,000 years ago, there were people in Northern Europe that were herding cattle or the ancestors of cattle, which they were doing originally not for dairy, but for meat and hides, which are obviously useful products to have. But let's say that because of that variation that I mentioned earlier, some people in the population, just because genes vary, happen to have the ability to digest dairy past weaning. So they had lactase persistence. Well, they were at an incredible advantage because their ability to have another food source made them better nourished than the individuals around them. And potentially, they also had a source, as some scientists suggest, of uncontaminated fluid. So they had an unpolluted kind of water source, and they had something else that gave them calories, and they were more likely to survive and reproduce and have kids that would then inherit this gene variation that they had.
And then that shows up in North European
exactly, that were cattle herding peoples.
And it doesn't
show
up.
There's also cattle herding peoples in Africa and some other parts of the world who also evolved this genetic difference. And so in those people, they now can digest dairy past the age of weaning, and it doesn't cause them any problem. And this has happened because of evolution that's then, of course, affected the practice of herding cattle, which then in turn influenced the likelihood that you were going to see more people with those genes.
Sure.
So it's a really cool kind of feedback between the genes for tolerating dairy and the cultural practice of herding cattle.
I thought another interesting example of the speed of evolution was your description of the Tibetans and their adjustment to high-altitude living.
Yeah, that's a less well-known example, but here, too, you can find genetic evidence that in people that have lived for a number of generations at very high altitudes, like 11,000 feet, that unlike you or I, well, now I'm making an assumption that you're not, you know, someone whose ancestors came from, you know, high altitude Tibet, but I'm going with that, and neither did mine. And so if you or I go to such high altitudes, I mean, we can adjust a little bit, but basically in the long run, it's really not good for us, and our physiology will suffer, and female fertility goes down, and there's all kinds of bad long-term effects that you have of living at really high altitudes. But in these Tibetan peoples, they have genetic changes that enable them to tolerate living at high altitudes and maintain, sort of essentially good health. And those changes have happened relatively recently because we know how long they've been living at those places, and we know who their ancestors were. So you can, you're actually able to read the signature of evolution in their gene.
And the interesting thing is, you're not just observing that Tibetans or people who grew up or were born and raised there have this ability to tolerate the altitude without getting altitude sickness, but you can actually measure, you can see something to do with hemoglobin or a gene that turns on.
Exactly, yeah.
Something to process oxygen.
So you're really able to look at the genes themselves, which again, I mean, it's to me, it's an amazing thing about even just the last few years. It's amazing how much evolutionary biology has changed what it can do just in the last like 5 or 10 years. That we can understand things at a level that we couldn't very, very recently.
Yeah, that's very amazing. We're speaking right now with Dr. Marlene Zook of the University of Minnesota. Dr. Zook, for the listeners that just joined us, we're speaking about a new book called Paleo Fantasy, What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. And we were talking about how new tools have given evolutionary biologists some new insights into the speed of evolution, for example. And I'm wondering, another topic that comes up in your book is some people talk about the impact of science and technology actually slowing or changing evolution because we control diseases that would otherwise have killed us off, or we manipulate genes in a way that protects people. What's your take on that?
So it's easy to think that evolution will have stopped for modern humans because, as you say, you know, individuals with genes that would have led to our, you know, early demise, you know, 1,000 years ago, you know, as little as 1,000 years ago, are now persisting in the population. I mean, I'm right now, you know, I'm short-sighted and I wear, you know, contacts, and, you know, I'm sure lots of the listeners are wearing glasses, and I'm pretty sure that we would all have been eaten by saber-toothed tigers, you know, 10,000 years ago, because we wouldn't have been able to see them coming until they got really close. So, you know, we're living and passing on our genes, whereas a long time ago that wouldn't have happened. At the same time, though, a better way, and the other big thing that's happened is the widespread use of contraception, at least in some societies. So we're controlling the way we reproduce in a way that never used to happen, and we're allowing individuals with certain genetic variants to live that never would have survived. But at the same time, there's a better way to think about this, I think, that came from an interview that I read with a primatologist, Mary Pavelka, at the University of Calgary, in which she said, you know, the question of are humans still evolving should be rephrased as, does everybody have the same number of children? And, of course, we don't. Mm-hmm. And people have widely different numbers of children, both. And the first, you know, answer to that is, of course, you know, we in a Western industrialized society think about having access to good health care and access to contraception. Neither of those are necessarily going to be the case in lots of parts of the world. So for many people, there is still differential reproduction that doesn't have anything to do with, you know, your medical care or, you know, your shelter from some of the, you know, nastier forces of nature. But the other thing is that even in a Western industrialized society, people are not all perpetuating the same, you know, representation of themselves into future generations. And what that's going to mean is that genes are going to change in the future, and so we're going to evolve. And this can actually be detected almost in real time. There's a great study of people in Framingham, Massachusetts, a town where a number of decades ago, the people started studying a number of health measures like blood pressure and weight and heart, you know, cholesterol and heart function and things like that. And it was all part of a very long-term study of, you know, what kinds of things we're going to make for heart health, and a lot of really interesting data that we generate a lot of interesting data that we now use for making health-related decisions. But there are some scientists who realize that if you have information on people's characteristics for multiple generations and you have information on how they reproduced, you can calculate what the population is going to look like, because people who reproduce more are going to pass on a greater proportion of the genes in the population to come. And when they did that, yeah, they found some changes. So, in case you're interested, I guess none of us are going to be around in 10 generations, because that, while a very short time from an evolutionary perspective, is still a little bit long for an individual lifetime. Nonetheless, if you were around in 10 generations, the women of Framingham are going to be just a little bit shorter. They're going to weigh about a kilo more on average, so a little over 2 pounds more on average. Their blood pressure is going to go down, and they're going to have slightly lower cholesterol. So they will have evolved.
That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to think about that happening on such a short time scale, because like I said, it's mostly when people think about, oh, you know, tell me about how evolution has happened, they think about the rise of the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about speed of evolution is it requires it relates to reproductive speed of the organism.
Yeah, absolutely.
In other words, you can't change until you reproduce, and so I gather there are amoebas or small invertebrates that change more rapidly because they reproduce so quickly.
Well, the real champions are our disease organisms.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, if you want rapid evolution, the champion is going to be, you know, a virus or a bacterium, where you get thousands and thousands of generations in the amount of time, you know, it takes us to walk to the grocery store. So, well, not exactly, but almost. And so, you know, there's really wonderful experiments going on now using microbes to understand the way evolution works, because of exactly what you said, that they have such rapid generation times that, you know, we can do this. And there's some scientists who are, you know, I mean, essentially playing God, where what they do is so a guy named Rich Lenski, who's at Michigan State University, has a big, what he calls experimental evolution lab, and he has bacteria that have been evolving for thousands of generations. And every, you know, several generations, he pulls some from the incubators where they're multiplying, and then he can freeze them and essentially put them in stasis. So it would be as if, you know, someone was watching evolution on Earth and then plucked out a few dinosaurs and stuck some T-Rex in the freezer, and then now could pull them out and say, oh, all right, now let's see what happens if we let those go in the Amazon.
Yeah.
And so it's not quite as colorful as that, because they really are just bacteria, but essentially, that's the same thing. And
yep.
So we can do that with microbes, and they're the real champions of rapid evolution.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of new information out and about now, and you cover a lot of these topics in your book that we're never going to get to. I was hoping we'd get to sex, but we're not going to make it. And
the
whole idea of have we evolved to be monogamous or what, and exercise and fitness, you talk about. You know, are we evolved to be runners or sprint marathon runners or sprinters? And I think your conclusion is that there's a variation in the human population.
There is.
And it's not so simple. You can't say, no, we're evolved to be marathon runners. Everybody's evolved to be a marathon runner. You talk about family structure and child rearing, what are we evolved? Can you make any comment on that, the whole idea of cooperative breeders and shared child rearing? Is that an evolutionary issue?
It looks like we evolved to share the care of our offspring. One thing that's very clear is that humans are shockingly needy as children, which will come as no surprise to any of the parents who are listening, humans, unlike all of our primate relatives, require an enormous investment when we're very young, and that investment seems to take more than just one person. So it's not surprising that we have families and extended families and communities that contribute to raising children, because that seems like it's been necessary for a really long time.
In conclusion here, you basically, in talking about giving up these paleo fantasies that say that there's never been a time when we've been in perfect sync with our environment, never will be, as long as the world continues to be what it is, and organisms are what they are, and change doesn't ever stop.
That's right, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, if we could only come back in 10 generations, as you indicated, I wonder what Buck and I here would look like at the radio station, if there would even be one. Well, Professor Zook, it's been a fascinating conversation, and your book is fascinating. It's called Paleo Fantasy, What Evolution Really Tells Us About Sex, Diet, and How We Live. It's a great read, very interesting topic. Thank you very much, Dr. Zook, for joining us here on The Roadhouse.
Thanks a lot for having me. My pleasure.